Today, we get one of the world's foremost editorial designers to talk us through a trio of his longest-running projects. Plus, our editor-in-chief tells us what he thinks the future of Southern California's preeminent legacy newspaper should be, and a title offering a glimpse into the private spaces of the global creative class. All that ahead of us today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. In the middle of his career, Mirko Borsa finds himself justifiably sitting near or at the very top of any credible list of the world's best editorial graphic designers. From titles like Zeit magazine that set the mark for mainstream newsstand design, to laboratories of weird and wonderful experimentation like the Free Sheet Superpaper, his work runs the gamut whilst always retaining an unmistakable visual signature. Monocle's Chiara Rimella recently visited Mirko at his studio in Munich. Chiara asked him to talk her through the latest issues of three of his long-running projects.
Mirko, we're sitting in your office, the place where all of these titles have been developed over the course of the last few weeks, months. What have you got for us?
I got like three different kinds of magazines or newspapers. I got Superpaper, which is a newspaper, and then I got Zeit magazine, which is a weekly supplement for the Zeit, and Kaleidoscope, it's an art magazine from Milano.
Very different weights. Let's work up to the weightier. So let's start with Superpaper, okay. Do you want to start with Zeit?
For me, it's very important because I do it already 10 years. I got my anniversary this year. The Zeit magazine got its anniversary, and me as well, like 10 years, both of it, also doing it every week. It's like a fellow which follows me all the time.
Well, no, I want to look at this week's issue. Okay. What have we got? So it's
Hello Neighbor is the one. And the other one I brought you is a fashion issue, like the fashion issue done by Jonas Lindström. And it's the first time we did, actually, it's like Jonas Lindström is a photographer, but he also does videos and music videos. For us, he did like kind of a fashion issue, which is a movie, which is we never did before. Like, I think it's like not a super new invention, but for us, it was something very special because he did like a 10-minute fashion movie and we took the stills to print them in a magazine. But at the same time, he also had the release of that 10-minute movie.
What's he done for you in this issue? Has he curated? What's his role within
his
the...
His role is like he did the direction, like together with us, the art direction, or he was like the director of the whole thing. As you see here, like he had somebody operating the camera. He was not operating the camera himself, but he did like photography inside of the magazine. So some of the shots, the whole thing is about youth culture and Berlin, people in Berlin.
How often do you do fashion issues?
Depends. It's like, because I think we do it for women. It's like 4 times a year. Men twice a year, and then we have like some different occasions like Berlin Fashion Week where we also have a fashion issue, but there's like both involved men and women around 9 times.
Do you approach them differently from a directing point of view?
Yeah, of course you do, because it's a different way of storytelling, because in the end you have to show clothes and you have to sell clothes. And that's not always easy. And like, there's so many fashion magazines which have like a lot more money and a lot more potential to do that. So we always have to find a certain kind of idea to have a different angle to like magazines like The Vogue or Harper's Bazaar. We always try to find a different angle. Like in that case, it was youth culture. Before that, there was a whole issue about love in Berlin and like couples who met in Berlin. Always like, we always tried to find a story around it, a narrative story, which is not just only related to the pictures.
What about the issue about neighbors? What's the lead story? So we have a cover that has, I guess, a side stall. The first cover is a stall on the side of a street with a wheelbarrow filled with pumpkins and potatoes on a table. Why this picture?
It's a suburb, which is a classic suburb, or it's a picture which presents a classic suburb in Germany, and this kind of tristesse which we all like know and which we all like. It's like an open, what you see here is like an open shop, so nobody's really selling stuff, you see a sign for €4, but you go there and leave €4, and then you can take a sack of potatoes. That's what you actually do. There's nobody selling the potatoes to you. And it's about a small village and all how these people come along with each other. It's a very local story, actually.
So is it a reportage on one specific...
It's a reportage on one very small village and how the people work live together. That's it. So Zeit magazine can be like everything. We can have like that big reportage, and or as we talked before, like can have fashion. We can have also like this very, very small, neat, kind stories.
Well, let's move on to Super Paper, which I feel is a little bit of a playground for experimentation in many cases, where there's room to go a little bit more wild.
Yeah, Super Paper is very special because a friend of mine had this idea of like, as you're like in almost every big city, you have like this kind of fanzines, which are about club culture, arts, fashion, something like that. And he wanted to do a newspaper out of it called Super Paper. I thought the name is super, like, not really good. It's, for me, it sounded strange and I didn't really like the name, but I liked the guy a lot. So we started the whole thing off, and it's all, now we're working in the moment on the 100th issue, which is quite an anniversary. He can live with like the outcome of all that, and he has two kids. Now he's this third kid and a wife, and they can live with the outcome, which is also good, also for 100 issues. And for us, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a playground. It just started with a very ambitious kind of newspaper design, and now it's something very, like, it kind of own category. Even the logo, you can't really read the logo anymore. It's about finding all these barriers around when is something really hard to read. Can I still read it? How can I force the reader to still read it? It's a little bit more than just a playground. It's like a lab.
Well, it's almost the opposite of the site in a way, because site
totally is, because like chaos rules everything in there. And I mean, we still work with classic elements. You still have headlines and you still have quotes in there. But sometimes we don't use quotes anymore or headlines. And then we just, you know, write everything down. And this is the actual January issue. So we also like have like shapes which go over the text, and you have like all these fades going over it, like almost like graffiti, and you have like all these lines going over it. And here you can still read it, but you're going to see like this wouldn't be possible in the Zeit magazine, and also not in all other classic magazines you would know. But we are pretty, like, you know, I think for us it's a lot of fun doing it, and it's very important because we learn as well a lot about readabilities, because a lot of people say like it's so classy, you always have like headline, then you have a teaser, and then the text starts. Like all systematics are known for ages already, and I think it's always worth rearranging it and trying something new, even if it wouldn't work out.
So what's in this issue?
In this issue is all actually it's always like the same. It's about like all the club evenings of the month, all the special DJs which are coming in the city, maybe sometimes with some interviews in the exhibitions, vernissages. And then we always have something called Village Voice. It's like a spin-off or like this American New Yorker idea of that newspaper Village Voice, a little bit of a name rip-off in that case. But also it always has like a different creative idea. In that case, it's about the guy who's doing it, Lukas Kubina, he has this idea of that Munich is like Wild West city and everybody's a cowboy and all Munich people are cowboys. And he's
you wouldn't say it from what I can see outside the window.
No, you wouldn't say it. You definitely wouldn't say it. But the weird thing is like we got this this bloke, he's dressed like an Indian and he's standing in front of the Haus der Kunst almost every day and he's dancing there. Then we have like a very well-known guy. His name is Willy Michels, so sorry. And he's dressed like a cowboy all the time. And it's like all these, he tried to find like all these hints about cowboys in Munich. Actually, it's not really true and there are no cowboys, but it's fun doing it.
Let's move on to the weightiest of the titles that we have in front of us. which brings us to Italy and out of Munich.
Yeah, it's Kaleidoscope. Kaleidoscope is like this art magazine which comes from Milano. Alessio Ascari, he's doing editor-in-chief. It's a biannual magazine. It's about contemporary art in the end, and it's a very small team doing it in Milano. It's Christina and him, basically, like doing the whole text and the arrangement of all text, and we are doing the art direction.
How do you go about mulling it over? How much do you mull it over, much more than Zeit, which is constant?
The thing is, like, if you do something just twice a year, it's always, you know, it always takes a while to get into it again and to find the right rhythm again. If you do like Zeit magazine, which is not basically not visually driven, but you can do it like beautiful if you want to. It's different if you do an art magazine, because there's like just a lot of visuals in there. So you have to hold yourself back as an art director in designing the whole thing, because otherwise you're going to be overwhelmed by all the artworks which are going to come in there. On the other hand, you want to do something which is contemporary and like which is state of the art in the moment, so you still need some design in there. It's a very fine line in between not overdoing the design but having still some in design, because if it's just a biannual, so it comes out just every half a year, it's a lot harder to make a certain design for a magazine which still reminds you of, like, of the last issue and gives like a footprint in all that industry, because there's so many well-designed magazines all around, but you always want to have like that kind of special form. And I think hopefully we did it with Kaleidoscope. The one we see here is the latest issue, and it's also the redesign issue, because we changed the whole design. We did it already for 3 years, and now we did a redesign on that.
What's new in the redesign?
It's totally, I mean, like the whole rhythm, the whole content is like basically the same. What we did before, we did a lot more design. Like, we had like the first pages, which are like, in my opinion, have been a little bit too ambitious, too over-designed. My fault in the end. And we reduced that completely to one typeface. Before, we used like 2 to 3 typefaces on the first pages. I can lead you through that. Here you go. It starts after a lot of advertising. You see it in here. And before that, we had like a lot different type sizes as well. And now the idea is, like, we have just for the first, like, all the turn pages in the beginning have all the same type sizes, you see, except like the captions. But the rest, like headlines, everything is like the same type size. The only idea is, like, on the left-hand side, it's a bold typeface. On the right-hand side, it's a regular typeface, which we thought it's just, you know, an elegant way of finding in like different weights in the layout and make the layout a little bit more special and, on the other hand, more vivid. So this is the beginning. And then later on, there's this main piece about one artist and a collection of different artists. And then that piece, we've been less playful with the typography in the past issues. We changed that now. In that part, we are like a lot more developing artworks for the artist, as you see, Alexander Birken. So like the word stretched over the whole spread. Or like we get like different openers now. Before that, we've been very, very simple on that. And what we use more than we did before, we have a lot more white space. So before that, the full magazine was like full of typography, full of design. And now we have margins, as you see here, like 3 to 4 centimeters white space. Most chief editors would just, you know, go crazy because you lose so much space to put some text in it.
Yeah, so how do you feel about the white space?
I always feel happy about the white space. I think that's one of our last punk rock playgrounds we have as graphic designers. It's just, you know, annoying people with white space. They pay.
That was Mirko Borsa talking to Chiara Ramella. You can read more of Chiara's interview with Mirko in the March edition of Monocle magazine, which will be on newsstands soon. This week, the Los Angeles Times got a new editor-in-chief. Jim Kirk, who's taking over from Lewis Dvorkin, faces a heady cocktail of challenges, including a trade union campaign by staff, corporate difficulties, and an organisational inability to retain good managers. Earlier this week, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé joined Monocle 24's Ben Ryland in our studios here at Midori House to give his view of the direction the paper should head at this critical juncture.
I think if you follow the story, there is, of course, just a lot of upheaval in the newsroom, and we're only hearing the newsroom side of it. You can probably well imagine that, of course, the paper has significant problems on the commercial side as well. But you've had a revolving door of reporters and, of course, editors as well. And, of course, amidst everything else at a time, you know, it, within the U.S. media landscape, when a number of course, not a number, I would say sort of most newspapers are in the midst of serious reinvention. And I think it's interesting how you highlight the East Coast, Ben, because, you know, the New York Times, you know, has managed to have, of course, a number of big stories. The New York Times has been pushing very hard, certainly of late, in terms of big investigations and really staying in the news. Wall Street Journal likewise as well. We've seen a bit of a refocus on the part of News Corp, a bit of a retrenchment internationally. So we've lost in Europe and also in Asia, we've lost the print editions of the Wall Street Journal. And of course, they really want to go for it in the US, you know, very much so against the Financial Times as well. And yet, as much as we look at problems, I look at sort of the opportunity that's being missed here, because you have this amazing LA moment. I mean, you have a city which is really occupying people's minds right now on every single level, whether it's politically, whether it's culturally, from an urban point of view. But where is the voice of the Los Angeles Times in terms of international mindset? So, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, Apple, you know, soon creating thousands of jobs in Culver City, you know, likewise, all of the other, you know, newcomers wanting to open up new studios, etc. Where is the LA Times as a voice of record in all of this? So, you know, that's what I look at. And so, you know, on one side, you know, you see that Jim Kirk is coming in as the new editor. To me, it's all opportunity what you could do. And if I was the parent company, Tronc, the rather clunkily named Tronc, as a as a parent organization, I'd be very excited about the future.
Well, you mentioned upheaval there, and that's actually one of the big takeaways, I think, that comes from the 2011 documentary about the New York Times, Page One, Inside the New York Times. There is quite a telling scene where they go to the other side of the country and they spend some time in the newsroom of the LA Times. And what you see is just a constant scene of upheaval of all kinds. There are all these different managers that filter through, and they've all got these amazing high-tech ideas of how they're going to create digital platforms and make everything more click-friendly. Mm. And that none of that seems to speak to what newspapers are actually supposed to be doing best, and that is reporting stories and really making us all remember that they actually still exist. And I think that's what the New York Times has done well, that's what the Washington Post has done well, is part of the story here that the LA Times has really lost track of its own story.
Yeah, I think that they've completely lost sight, and you sort of wonder, you know, from the parent company side, from Tronc, you know, what have they sort of set down as a 3-year, as a 5-year plan for this? So, you know, I think if they came to us and they were having a discussion about, you know, what should be done, this should be the West Coast newspaper of record. You know, if it's not going to be them, then it should be up the coast in San Francisco. But, you know, there is a listen, we know there's an APAC moment. There's a West Coast moment, and they're just missing it. And yet, I think with strong leadership, a good editor, a good publisher, and a proper plan, I think that they could be serious challengers and, you know, sit amongst the Washington Post, the Journal, and the New York Times properly.
When we talk about the potential readership that the LA Times could have, we're talking about a state here, California, that is very politically active. There are a lot of people, and we know all about this, in that state, who are very engaged in their own politics, in federal politics, and they are quite... they tend to vote quite differently to a lot of the other surrounding areas. So when we talk about those people, they are the kind of people who would probably want to buy a newspaper if they were given the option of buying one that was really speaking to them. How do you see the challenges of the LA Times building back that trust with those people? How can they do that?
Well, I think it's going to have to be, you know, innovation. I think that, you know, here you're sitting on a coast, which of course is known for also, you know, fantastic design, whether we're talking digitally, whether it's, you know, on the good old printed page. So the paper needs a complete overhaul. It needs a new mission as well. And I think we talk about, you know, being a voice of record. You look at, you know, the fires, the floods in and around Santa Barbara, everything that has happened over the last 2 months in California. And, you know, when I was flipping on you know, BBC, when I was looking at other outlets, again, I was like, where is the LA Times, where are their correspondents in this story? I didn't see them inserting themselves. So you're also wondering, are news desks also thinking, this is the paper that I'm going to go to for the editor? So I think they would have to work very hard there. And also, you know, how do you get into also, you know, we always talk about a California sense of lifestyle and a California sort of mindset. And I think there, okay, you know, what the paper does, maybe Monday to Friday, Saturday is one thing. But what we do know is that there are room for weekend papers, and there's money still in weekend papers as well for advertisers. And you, again, you just talk about the sheer size of the California market. But if, you know, I think the main thing I would do, Ben, is I would say I wouldn't treat this paper as something which is contained within the Los Angeles city limits. This is a West Coast paper. I think you should be in Vancouver and want to pick it up. Likewise, you know, they should be the top of their game. You know, when we don't know what's going to happen yet with Vanity Fair, new editors, etc., happening there. You know, this again should take up a bit of the space that the Hollywood Reporter has, that Variety has. You know, it should be, from a daily paper's point of view, also the most important, you know, title for pop culture as well.
That was Monocle's editor in chief Tyler Brulé in conversation with Ben Rylan. There's an abiding interest in the private spaces where creative people live and work. Just consider the preservation of writers' homes and offices by historical societies, and the success of personality-led interiors magazines like Appartamento. Open House is a title that takes readers into the homes and workplaces of creative people the world over, with handsomely illustrated stories published both in the language of the author and in English. Founded 4 years ago by Andrew Trotter and Marie-Luce Vidal, the latest issue of the title marks a redesign. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with them earlier.
We started 4 years ago. Well, actually, we started before that, but the magazine started 4 years ago. Before that, we were flatmates and we were living together, and our house was a gallery of photography. Marie-Luce had the idea to open the house and show her work. And we did one exhibition, and from that one exhibition, it just sort of took off in a very organic way. And we, in the end, we had six exhibitions in the house. We lived with a Japanese chef. And during that time of opening the house, we started to realize that other people around the world were doing similar things. So 4 years ago, we had quite a few little stories together, and we started to look for a few more. And this is how the magazine started itself.
And Marie-Luce, I want to ask you, because of course you cover the most amazing residences and houses, which I'm always in love with. What's the process like to choose which residences you're going to put on the magazine? Because I can see, you know, they all make sense. There's not a single house there that I wouldn't like to live on.
We are looking for always for houses that are open to the public, because we are like making a community or a guide about the community of the people that share their own space. So the main thing is like somebody opened the space for share different activities, or always around the art and design and gastronomy or different ways, but also has to be with a nice house or nice space. So it has to live together, no? The activity and also the aesthetic of the place or the design.
A lot of people think that we're a magazine about design, and in the end, design comes into it, but really we're about the projects that the people do. Open House is really about people who are making communities and really sharing something with the people around them and people who also go to their cities. So really, we're not looking necessarily for amazing, beautiful houses. It just happens to be that a lot of people who do these projects also live in very beautiful houses, you know, and everything like that. So it's a byproduct of the magazine itself.
And Andrew, I have the latest issue here with me. The magazine has been going through a redesign as well. I mean, for those who are readers like me, you know, and I have to say, it does look amazing. But can you tell us a couple of the changes that you've done in the latest issue?
We decided to work with Folk Studios, who is a graphic design company here in Barcelona, but they're very well known. We were always very happy with the design before, and with Nagori, our old graphic designer who was in San Sebastian, it was just always a little bit difficult because she was in a different place. And we felt like we wanted to be with a graphic design team close to us, so we could see during the process of designing each issue that we could see them every day if we needed to, you know, and be together. When you're together, you make a lot of different changes. And this way, we've always worked with them on photographic shoots, working with brands and everything like this. And it was just sort of a natural experience, a natural way to go together to work. And with the new issue, both myself and Mary Luth, well, Mary Luth is coming up to 40 next year. And I'm 45. And having this way, we needed some young people around us.
Ooh, secrets have been revealed.
it's not overly a secret, but we're not so millennial. And, you know, to have a team that are also very forward-thinking in the ways of magazines and webs and things like this, it was very important for us.
I mean, for me also, the one main change that we have made in this issue is that we made the magazine more readable. We give more space to the text. All interviews we do in the original languages and also in English, and we publish bilingual. We publish in both languages. We give more space to the text and we make more easy to read. Maybe before we give more space to the photography and was more visual. No, and now I think the image and the text are on the same level. And I think this is important.
And Mariluz, I would like to ask you, so you mentioned that, you know, you published the interviews in the original language as well. So, for example, in this latest issue, you have some text in Italian, in French. And so it feels like very much like of a pan-European title, even though I believe you're also published in Spain. Do you consider yourself like an European publication or Spanish publication? Or
a European publication, I will say. I mean, we are based here in Barcelona, but...
I mean, I'm English. Even if I lived here now 9 years, I don't feel Spanish at all. You know, it's I'm English. Mary Luth is Spanish. But also the magazine, it's worldwide. You know, we write in Japanese, in Chinese. And the reason behind this is we always believed that yes, of course, we could interview everybody in English and write in English. The people themselves talk better in their own language. You express yourself in your own language. So we try to find a writer in the language of the person. Often we even try and find writers who are involved in the project or know the project. And this way it becomes more friendly. And when you're doing things in a more close, friendly way, you get more out of a person. So it wasn't just enough to make, for instance, an interview in Chinese and then translate it into English. We wanted to be able to publish in both languages because we also understand that we're selling the magazine around the world. And it's really, of course, most people will half understand the English or not understand the English. Or we go in English for everything because it's international. But then somebody comes along and goes, this interview is in Italian and I can read it, you know, I can read in my own language. And I think it's nice for the people.
Guys, I would like to ask you as well about whoever you want to answer this, about your business model. Of course, you come twice a year. I wonder if you know, to finance the magazine and everything, you have, you know, advertising or is sales on newsstands, a subscription service. We always like to know about those things here on the Stack.
We started with a crowdfunding to get the first issue out. And since then, we've always been self-published. So from the sales, it pays for publishing each issue because we don't want to be taken over by advertising. So we find brands that really fit together really well with the magazine. And they, in the end, they all become friends and we do things together, even events and everything like this. And as it grows, we have each time a little bit more advertising, but we try to make that advertising fit into the magazine. Since the beginning, we've never actually put money into the magazine from our own pockets, and it keeps on just growing. And it's a little bit of everything, advertising, sales of the magazine, when we do events with brands, when we do events for ourselves and everything else.
That was Andrew Trotter and Mariluz Vidal from Open House, and issue 8 is out now. And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our production team of Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And of course, our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. Find Fernando at fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the very same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.